This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, the United States, which has violated the national sovereignty of countless countries, cries foul over Ukraine. Community outrage over the firing of a black professor at Temple University. And President Obama keeps his promises to rich people. But first, another suit has been filed charging the United Nations is liable for infecting Haiti with a cholera epidemic that has killed 10,000 people and sickened hundreds of thousands of others. The United States recently went on record in support of giving the UN immunity from prosecution. We spoke with Dr. Jemima Pierre, a professor of African American and Diaspora Studies at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. She says there's no mystery to why the U.S. favors immunity for the UN in Haiti.
Well, the U.S. actually has to do that because if it goes against the U.N., it's going against its own military occupation of Haiti. And so it had to support the U.N.'s impunity in Haiti because to not do so would mean that it's challenging its own power over the U.N., but also its continued control over Haiti and Haiti's sovereignty. And so what's interesting is, you know, I always say the U.S. is as responsible, if not more, for the cholera outbreak in Haiti as the UN, because it's because of the military occupation that we have cholera. And the presence of the UN in Haiti is exactly related to the U.S. coup d'etat, the removal of the democratically elected president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, his removal from office by the U.S. government, and then bringing in the UN to basically cover this dirty work and by making it legitimate. And so this military occupation is absolutely outrageous because Haiti was not at war. It did not need armed military people there. And the reason the U.S. did it is because they knew that what they did was create a coup d'etat. And so in that case, to not deal with cholera means it's perfect U.S. policy.
So the United States is actually protecting its own impunity in the guise of the U.N.
Yes, definitely. The establishment of the U.N. is so dubious. It's unbelievable, right? So the U.S. goes in, they enforce an illegal coup d'etat, and then they bring in Brazil and Latin American countries and all these other countries all over the place to come in and cover for them. And so in addition to that, cholera is just one of the many egregious things that have happened to Haiti by the U.N., right? So you have the gruesome acts of sexual abuse, murder, theft, and overall thuggery since the U.N. has been there. All that goes right back to the U.S. And so I actually support the class action lawsuits, the attempt by, you know, Haitians and their supporters to get redress through the court system. But I also think a more important struggle is to actually demand the removal of this military occupation from Haitian land and for Haitians to actually reclaim their sovereignty from the U.S.
We have also learned through WikiLeaks and other sources that in 2010, 6 years after the U.S.-backed coup in Haiti, the United States proposed to overthrow and exile another Haitian president, René Préval.
Yes, and this is important, right, because this is around the time where, right after the cholera outbreak, they wanted to install a puppet government, which they, of course, succeeded in doing, right? Sweet Mickey Martelly is the perfect puppet. He's a Duvalierist. He's there trying to really establish another dictatorship that Obama is definitely completely behind, right? And so they threatened to fly Préval out the same way that they flew out Aristide if Préval didn't step back and allow them full access to Haiti. And full access to Haiti meant the control of the electoral process in whatever guise that was, because that it was a sham. They basically installed their own puppet. And if Préval didn't step back and allow the renewal of their UN mandate, the installation of their own puppet, Préval would be taken out of the country. So Préval knew that he couldn't fight against these forces, which is why he stepped back and allowed them to do that.
And this ongoing occupation seems to be open-ended. That is, there are no guidelines, no bar for the Haitians to meet to end the occupation. It seems arbitrary, capricious, and with no rhyme or reason other than to control Haiti's internal affairs.
Well, yes. There's nothing else except for the minerals that have been discovered, you know, in northern parts of Haiti, the potential oil that is there, and also access to Latin America, having a military base there so that the U.S. can have a military presence in the Caribbean against, you know, the growing leftist governments of Latin America. And also, we have to admit that there's something else going on in terms of Haiti, and part of that has to be Haiti's continuing to pay for its original sin of going against white supremacy back in 1804, which is why it was no surprise to us that the coup d'etat that happened in 2004 happened at the exact anniversary, the 200th anniversary of the Haitian independence, right? And so we have to remember all of these things when we think about the way that the U.S. deals with Haiti, black president or no.
And now the United States is speaking in the highest and mightiest tones about national sovereignty regarding Ukraine and charging that Russia is the big villain in the world trying to usurp Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity.
Yeah, well, you know, you can't help but just laugh at that, right? So when you hear some of these statements by Kerry and by Obama, you can't help but laugh. As we think about the U.S. actions in Libya, the U.S. actions in Haiti, the U.S. actions in Iraq, Afghanistan, but Haiti and Libya are the most egregious to me because they basically threw in the Marines and forced a president out of a country. And no one says anything. No one even bats an eyelash. And you bring in a military occupation that basically kills 9,000 people, which is three times more people who died in the September 11 attack. No one says a word. And so part of this discussion around sovereignty is laced with white supremacy and racism. But also, it's really interesting then that the mainstream press will go on and become the mouthpiece of the Obama administration, talking about Ukraine and so on and so forth, and never say a thing when it comes to Haiti. What this does is basically really opens up the door to seeing what U.S. foreign policy, what U.S. imperialism is all about. And it's not about justice, it's not about democracy, but it's about this rogue nation on its last legs.
And yet Latin American nations, especially Brazil, have been integral to the ongoing occupation of Haiti.
Right, and that's the thing. Part of my disappointment with the Latin American government, perhaps maybe I'm less disappointed with Chavez because Venezuela doesn't play as big a role in the occupation of Haiti as Brazil. But Brazil is using Haiti as its training grounds, right? You know, the same military forces who were in Haiti, part of this UN occupying a mission, are the ones taking care of black folks in the favelas as people protest land grab and displacement because of the World Cup that's coming there this summer. And so Brazil is basically using Haiti as a way to actually flex his muscle and to find a way to get to the United Nations Security Council. In that sense, I'm really disgusted. I'm disgusted at Brazil. I'm disgusted at all these African nations who have troops. So Minister, if you go to Haiti, what you see is the military troops that are underground that are posted all over the country, the UN troops, are from all over the global south, right? Those at the head of MINUSTAH are from the Europeans. So there's like even a racial hierarchy in terms of who the military patrols are versus who controls the UN in Haiti. And so to have African nations, there are troops from Senegal, troops from Uganda, all these troops in Haiti maintaining a particular kind of military occupation of a black country is really disappointing. And then Brazil wanting to use this as a way to raise itself in the eyes of the international community, making it complicit in U.S. imperial policy in Haiti, is even more disturbing for me.
And so in Haiti, we have the global south occupying militarily the global south on behalf of the global north.
Exactly. And that's how the U.S. is working now, right? In terms of, you know, if you think about AFRICOM on the African continent, what's happening is basically deploying a handful of U.S. soldiers here and there and getting the Africans themselves to police themselves on behalf of this U.S. power. And that's something we actually need to really pull out from under the rug and really put out there and tell people this is what's happening, right? What's happening is the U.S. using these smaller countries who are trying to have a broader platform and using them to get what they want at the expense of poor black and brown folk.
the African Union's peacekeeping, that's what they call it, peacekeeping operation in Somalia, is actually directed by the United States and hands-on by the CIA.
Definitely. That's key. And I think part of it is once the CIA got rid of all the radical African leaders from the 60s on, what we've had is just clientelism, you know, and most of these African leaders are nothing but puppets for the West and the U.S. And so the African Union itself is even a bigger disappointment in that it allows itself to be used. And now with the growing presence of AFRICOM and U.S. using what they call soft military power to get Africans to fight one another, it's going to make colonialism seem like child's play very quickly.
What's left of radicalism in terms of leadership and among the people in Haiti?
Well, Haiti can always surprise us, and so I'm holding out hope. As the masses, we have to go back and listen to the masses. And what's going on right now, there's this mass revolt going against, for example, there's this island, Île Lavache, that Matali has signed over to developers to become a tourist destination, and the local people have been organizing left and right against that. And so I think, you know, there's this swelling of grassroots protest against the takeover of the island, and those are the people we have to look to. And they're the ones that have to live every day under this military occupation by the UN, and they're the ones that have to pay the price through cholera and other diseases and sexual exploitation. And so those are the people we have to look to. I mean, cause at this point, the installed puppet government, he's filling his pockets and he's, you know, making money. And Obama, of course, just recently actually took a picture with Michel Martelly for the first time, basically giving him some kind of legitimacy. So the radical movement might seem kind of dead right now, but I think we have to look to the local people. And there's going to be a time where the grassroots folks are going to rise up against this puppet government and its Washington backers. And then what usually happens is that if the puppet government doesn't work well enough, you know, Washington will just drop them. So Matali needs to watch out in that sense as well. But, you know, I hold out hope for the radical people in Haiti on the ground doing the day-to-day stuff, and I think something's going to happen sooner rather than later. And I think Haitians will surprise once again. We just need to be ready to support them when they do come up against this tyranny of U.S. imperialism.
That was Dr. Jemima Pierre, professor of African American and Diaspora Studies at Vanderbilt University. Dr. Pierre is also an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. The United States and Europe are crying crocodile tears over the intention of most people in the Crimea to leave the Ukraine and rejoin Russia. In the mid-90s, the U.S. and Europe actively encouraged the breakup of the nation of Yugoslavia into a handful of separate states. Back then, Washington cared nothing about preserving Yugoslavia's territorial integrity. For some insight in the region, we call Dr. John Quigley, professor of international law at Ohio State University, who was once a research scholar at Moscow University in the old Soviet Union.
That's right. When Yugoslavia's different sectors began to want to separate, Germany, as you say, was the most active, I would say, in supporting that. And it's been wrong for the international community as a whole to go along, including, I might say, the government of Ukraine, which was one of the first to recognize those entities that were breaking off. So I do find it a bit odd that the Western powers, and in particular the United States, are showing so much concern about the possibility of Crimea breaking off from Ukraine.
The question of national self-determination has its principled dimensions, but when it comes down to it, there are particular situations. Does Crimea have a case for a national self-determination that everyone else should respect?
Well, I think it does. It is an entity that has a certain history that is quite odd in that it formerly was part of Russia. That dates back to the late 18th century, and it was put into Ukraine only in 1954. The population remains more, you might say, affiliated psychologically, at least, with Russia than with Ukraine. And the sentiment for departing from Ukraine is fairly strong. I was there 20 years ago as an expert for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe and spoke at that time with the representative of the Parliament of Crimea. And they were very strong insistence on self-determination. They threw that at me and said, don't we have the right to self-determination? And I think they probably do.
Many folks point to people in positions of authority now in the present configuration in Ukraine as fascists. But without using the term as an epithet, aren't people high up in government, the dominant force, in fact, in Ukraine, making noises that Russian speakers elsewhere in the country should be very anxious about?
Well, there is a party that is, we might call it an extreme right-wing party, that is significant in the government, in the parliament, and which was apparently behind the vote that they took in the parliament to repeal an earlier law that allowed for minority languages in those parts of Ukraine where they are spoken. That earlier law was repealed shortly after the parliament voted Mr. Yanukovych out of office. That repeal, in turn, was vetoed by the president of the country when they saw the new president, when they saw the reaction they were getting to it. But the fact that the parliament was able to pass that in the first place caused great concern and was one of the reasons why we saw the initial activity on the Russian side.
The United States is making loud noises about national sovereignty and the principles of non-interference in other countries' affairs. I don't hear the word or the term or references to Haiti coming up in this debate, a country that the United States sponsored a coup in 2004 and then invaded with its own military forces and which is now essentially a protectorate of the United Nations. Nobody's talking about Haiti's national sovereignty.
Yes, I think one can well question the even-handedness of the action of the United States with respect to a number of parts of the world.
And, of course, the United States was the prime sponsor of the new state of southern Sudan, broken off from Sudan in Africa.
That's right. And it's important to note that the referendum vote for South Sudan to separate from Sudan occurred only in the South Sudan portion. Samantha Power, who is our representative in the United Nations, said a few days ago that she thought that if a referendum is to be held for the separation of Crimea, then it would have to be throughout the entirety of the territory of Ukraine. That's quite out of line.
Yes, how can we talk about people's right to self-determination if another people have to give their assent to it?
Precisely. I mean, the essence of the right to self-determination is that the particular people has that right.
Where do you think the situation is going? Clearly, there's not going to be a legal meeting of the minds here.
I think that's right. There won't be anything definitive done in the UN Security Council because of the great power veto situation. There could be something done a bit more aggressively in the economic sense by the European Union. But for now, as far as Crimea is concerned, it seems to me that if the vote goes in favor of separation and if Russia, as it seems prepared to do, accepts Crimea into its territory, I don't see any way in which that will be changed.
And finally, most historians recognize that the American independence movement from Britain would have been impossible without the intervention of France.
Yes, the activity of outside parties can be very important, and your analogy is apt here that Russia is, in a way, facilitating. That shouldn't, I think, be seen as such a negative as is being portrayed, I think, by some of our officials. That is, they're saying that the vote in Crimea will be kind of under the gun. But I can tell you, having spent time in Crimea, the sentiment for separation has been very strong for a very long time. So This is not a vote that will be under the gun.
Professor John Quigley of the University of Ohio. Demonstrations were held in cities across the United States to protest U.S. saber rattling over events in Ukraine. Sarah Flounders is with UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition. She says anti-war sentiment is high because the stakes are clearer in Ukraine, where fascists overthrew the elected government.
I think there's less confusion on many groups on the left that there was a fascist coup in the Ukraine, or the right-wing, extreme right-wing, absolutely racist, anti-Semitic, connected to the Nazi Party right-wing that has seized power in the Ukraine. And there have been many articles explaining just who these figures are. It's not as difficult to find as in another time on U.S. wars in Yugoslavia, ongoing U.S. operation in Syria to bring down the government, or in Libya. But what is different for years now is there is an enormous passivity by what had been the organized movement at a time when there is enormous opposition. The overwhelming majority of the population is against another war. It's very interesting on the Ukraine that you could be on any street corner distributing material and get a very good response from people going by. Even if President Obama is meeting with this fascist Yatsenyuk, the new prime minister, his grouping simply seized the power from the elected government, that may be happening on one level, but the population here, their greatest concern is not another war. And so it's an open door. There have been actions just in the last few days in 18 cities just from a call that there must be a response and to say not another war and no to this fascist coup. But the crisis is spiraling forward, and that will impel people into action because it's such a dangerous time. And the propaganda is unrelenting. It has been from day one the message that Russia is invading the Ukraine, that Russia is moving forces, and at the very time that it's the U.S. who's moving forces, who's moving jets, who's moving destroyers into the Black Sea, a drone brought down over the Crimea. So there are all kinds of military operations coming from the U.S.
But isn't that amazing? The events in the Ukraine are depicted as Russia, a binge of expansionism, when it is NATO that has expanded all the way to the borders of Russia, violating a commitment that was made to the Russians at the time of the breakup of the Soviet Union.
That's so true. That's exactly what this is all about, in a major, major part, about the expansion of NATO, the expansion and domination of the U.S. and European Union as a market. NATO has already spread to 12 countries since the collapse of the Soviet Union, although there had been an agreement, a commitment, that there would be no NATO expansion. But what's NATO? It's the U.S. commanded and equipped military alliance. And the encirclement of Russia and China is what it's all about. And that aggressive momentum, if anything, is steamrolling even faster. When NATO expands, it means a whole series of new military bases. It also means that the country that enters NATO has to replace all of its military equipment with U.S. military equipment. So it's a huge arms sale, and its indebtedness to the country, whether it's Poland or the Czech Republic or Hungary, it means huge debts for now to the Ukraine, a country already $140 billion in debt. Its debt will skyrocket because all those missiles that come in and tanks. But it also means that the entire officer corps is then trained by NATO, has to be loyal to NATO. So this is really about the encirclement of Russia. And always keeping in mind that Russia is the largest oil and gas producer in the world. that the pipelines go through the Ukraine into Europe. And in great part, this is also the sanctions that the U.S. is determined to impose on Russia are about breaking that transaction, that market. That would make Europe totally dependent on the U.S., along with, of course, it's meant to destabilize economically Russia. But if the oil and gas from Russia no longer flow through the Ukraine based on sanctions into Europe, it's actually the U.S. who's slated to be, within the next 2 years, the largest producer of oil and gas due to fracking. And billions of dollars have been invested into this extremely dangerous form of oil production. And it is desperate for a market. So shutting off the Russian market and exporting that market is exactly now what is all abuzz in Washington.
The U.S. oil and gas industry may be riding high, but American cities are very much on low. There is no bailout in the cards from Republicans or Democrats for Detroit or other American urban centers. But the United States is talking about giving a $10 billion loan guarantee to the fascists in Ukraine.
Well, that's exactly the situation. And $10 billion is just the beginning. And there's also, of course, the $5 billion that Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland bragged had already gone to this right-wing opposition in the Ukraine. At the very time that we're told the SNAP, the food supplement program, there wasn't enough money. And they cut $8 billion from this program, the most basic sustenance, having enough to eat. And it's not adequate as it is, and nevertheless, they cut it back in the U.S. from that is literally stealing food from the mouth of children who are the overwhelming recipient of this program. Not enough money. $8 billion cut, and at the drop of hat, $10 billion to the Ukraine. But that's not really $10 billion to the Ukraine. It's $10 billion to U.S. banks. It doesn't go anywhere. It's a paper transaction. It goes to guaranteed loans that the Ukraine has paid, and it means huge austerity programs in the Ukraine and in cities like Detroit. Just as when you look at in the Ukraine, you have an imposed government. When you look at Detroit, what do? They put the city in receivership. They just did away with the elected government. They said that the vote there meant nothing and that they could appoint someone to come in and rob the pensions so that Detroit could pay its bills. It's not much different than what's happening in the Ukraine. With this, there is one big difference, and that is that the coup in the Ukraine, you can picture what it would be here if the head of the Ku Klux Klan were suddenly named the head of the national police, officially, as the head of the neo-Nazi Svoboda Party, was just named the new Minister of Defense. And the head of the right sector is now the second in command of the National Defense and Security Council.
That was Sarah Flounders of UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition. President Obama's critics say he thinks nothing of breaking his campaign promises. But that's not quite true. Obama does keep the promises he makes to the rich. Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
The most important thing about a promise, as David Graeber in his book Debt, the First 5,000 Years explains, is who makes it and to whom it is made. Promises made among equals are freely made and freely kept or freely disregarded when the parties deem it convenient. If your brother-in-law doesn't repay you the money you lent him this time last year, you might be disappointed, but you're unlikely to involve the courts and the state in your family affairs. On the other hand, if your brother-in-law borrowed that money from Bank of America, a late payment or a series of them is certain to bring punitive repercussions down upon the debtor, backed by the full force of the state. So the promises which poor men and women make to each other are not at all the same as the promises that the poor are obliged to make to the wealthy or to the state in whatever sort of society they live in. governments enforced the promises the poor make to the rich, ultimately at gunpoint. But what about when the wealthy and powerful make promises to the poor? Wealthy corporations and the politicians fronting for them invariably promise tens of thousands of new, good-paying local jobs in return for this or that tax break, this or that suspension of environmental regulations, loan guarantee, or other piece of corporate welfare. Nobody blinks an eye when it turns out they've lied, and practically no mechanisms exist to restore the public property which malefactors obtain in this way. The promises of politicians, both during and after their campaigns, seem to have the same character. By the first days of his presidency, Barack Obama made direct promises to see NAFTA renegotiated, to raise the minimum wage in his first months in office, to close Guantanamo, to create a path to citizenship for the undocumented, to make union organizing easier, to cease kidnapping, secret imprisonment, and torture, and to craft an open, transparent process for the drafting of what became known as Obamacare. The thing of it is that all these were promises made to poor people. Thus, they were of little value and soon disregarded. But they were not his only promises. Barack Obama made other early promises as well, to wealthy interests, to the Pentagon, to Wall Street and London banksters, to charter school sugar daddies, to the galaxy of public employees and private contractors, euphemistically known as the intelligence community. He promised them that no torturers would stand trial, that military manpower and budgets would continue to rise, that greedy drug companies and private health insurers would be protected over the public, that so-called entitlements would be reined in, and that Wall Street would be protected against the mobs and their pitchforks, and apparently that public education would be privatized. Unlike his promises to the poor, President Obama has striven mightily to keep all these. With a good 33 months left in the White House, President Obama apparently has a few more promises to make and keep. If the first 63 months of his tenure are any guide, and you want to know which promises will be kept, the handwriting is on the wall. The promises made to the wealthy and powerful will get first priority. The promises made to the legions of ordinary people who made his career possible, not so much.
Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's most well-known political prisoner, earned the hatred of the Philadelphia police for his diligent radio reporting on the police vendetta against MOVE, which was attacked by police in a deadly raid in 1978. In 1985, police bombed the MOVE house, burning down an entire neighborhood block and killing 11 people. Now, after all these years, the police are once again whipping up anti-MOVE hysteria. Mumia Abu-Jamal files this report for Prison Radio.
In all my years, I've never seen such biased, negative, and nasty news coverage as I have of the Philadelphia-based MOVE organization. There may be an exception. The coverage of the so-called Central Park Five, the young men charged and later cleared in the rape and beating of a young New Yorker, possibly. But both are test cases in media demonization. They just occurred in different cities. Remember the recent brouhaha over a rock and roll racist who called the president a subhuman? Editorials readily used such terms to depict MOVE, but they rarely do so these days. They are more sophisticated. Yet demonization remains. This tactic today is used as a pretext and a precursor for war. Remember Saddam Hussein called insane, or Muammar Gaddafi likened to Daffy Duck? This is but the press marching with their ink pens to wars of words. A recent article in the Philadelphia magazine entitled Lost Boy was full of innuendo and suggestion that MOVE folks beat and attack their children. The article, detailing the life and untimely demise of the man once known as Birdie Africa, was at bottom a smear piece on MOVE. Why? Why now? Because MOVE people are up for parole now, for their minimums have all been served. all of the survivors of the police attack on MOVE of August 8, 1978, have spent over 30 years in prison. Now it's time to slime them, according to the press. They do it in a more sophisticated way today, but they do it. They even gratuitously publish bits of letters from MOVE people, which gives illusion of balance. But the slant remains. MOVE is bad. Police, good. How anyone could write about the massacre of May 13, 1985, and not announce that city cops killed 11 men, women, and babies with murderous intent blares the slant of the entire piece. Cops are quoted saying stuff that suggests they never kill kids, as they are killing kids. Former police chief Gregor Sambor told members of the MOVE Commission that children, MOVE children, were considered combatants. Think of that. Combatants. Those children, combatants, were bombed and burned to death for the city of their birth. Yet the slant is a child was forced to eat fruit instead of candy and fresh vegetables instead of Twinkies. Slant wins again, huh?
Munir Abu Jamal speaking from Frackville State Prison in Pennsylvania. Community and student activists thought they had won a victory last year when they forced the administration of Temple University in Philadelphia to respect the autonomy of its African American Studies Department. The protests were largely organized by Professor Anthony Montero, who has taught in the department for a decade. Montero endorsed Professor Molefi Asante, a proponent of so-called Afrocentrism, as the department's new chairman. However, no sooner had Asante taken the job than he collaborated with the Dean of Liberal Arts, Teresa Soufas, to terminate Dr. Montero's contract. Last week, hundreds of student, community, and labor activists gathered outside Sullivan Hall on Temple's campus to demand that Montero be reinstated with tenure. Inside the building, the university's Board of Trustees was meeting. Henry Nicholas, president of 1199C, the Hospital and Healthcare Employees Union, spoke to the crowd outside Sullivan Hall. Nicholas said they needed to move the protest to where the power was.
I've been around here long. I was here when we were fighting to get black studies in this institution. And I'm the largest union in the Temple complex, but I'm troubled by the fact that all of the people who understand what justice looks like is out here and not in there. Are you listening? We should be in there where the decisions are being made. To be explicit and clear, we should be at the trustees meeting right now, not out here. And if we want the justice that we're entitled to, then we will be stopped being, oh, they think you're doing a good thing for being out here because they don't have to listen to you. We need to be inside where the trustees are meeting.
Zachary Rhodes, a longtime activist in the fight against homelessness and hunger, also addressed the crowd outside Sullivan Hall. She agreed with union leader Henry Nicholas.
We need to be in that building because we paid for it. This building is a paper building.
Right.
It's sitting in North Central Philadelphia. What was done to Dr. Montero, and I want to speak to all you other black professors on this campus. They're going to get you too. You sitting in car behind these white folks, they're going to get you too. Soufas is a goddamn racist. She's a racist heifer. And she, along with her friend, Dr. Asante, who needs to atone for what he's done. If any of you students or you people know anything about the Temple News, Dean Soufas stated that Dr. Asante came to her and ask for her to fire Dr. Montero. I'm saying this for some of you, and if you're romancing about Dr. Sante, what Dr. Sante did, he didn't do it by himself. If it wasn't for the black community, this department wouldn't be here. We can't let Asante and nobody else, I don't give a damn if they're black, purple, or blue, come and bullshit black people and poor people in this community.
That's right.
Now, if he's working with her, he has to come and atone. Because Dr. Montero came to me and the community almost in tears, begging and pleading, asking for us to come up and stand up for Asante. Oh. Then he turn around and take a knife and stab him in his neck, and he's working in concert with Dean Sobers, who said there is no black community.
Uh-oh.
But these people in this building, I'm telling you, we need to be in that building. If they don't let us in, we need to stay there.
That's right.
See, all of this is fine. Don't get nothing in this world that should raise hell. They sitting in there in a warm spot while we outside. They know what they've done is wrong.
Right.
Asante know what he did is wrong.
Right.
And Asante thinks that he's going to stay here because we're demanding that Super's ass be put out of here. And what's she going to do? She's going to say, he ain't got no gang no more. So you think she's going to leave him here? I could care less. I'm only interested in young African-American children, Caucasian children who are going for it. It's about the youth.
Come on.
I take, you take a little money and more than I can afford out of my husband out for taxes. We paying for white folks to spit in our face, call us niggers, use multiculturalism. They ain't even calling you a nigger. Have people like Asante sit behind and plot on black people. And we use the word African centricity. What the f*** is that? Does it mean one thing for black people over here? And one thing for black people over in the continent, you got a public housing back here, been back here forever. That program has been here over 25 years. How many of those African-American women and children had the cure for cancer, for the all these other calamities could be in Norris homes if somebody had gone and promoted them young people back there? Asante didn't do it. Supers didn't do it. The president of the school's not doing it. You gotta stop romanticizing about treachery. We hear the word terror. This is terror against black folks. This man has been an honorable black man in this community.
Yeah,
that's right.
When you call him, he don't say no. I tell him, I say, stop falling and helping Pam. Stop helping Sakari. He say no. He goes all the time. Because you know why, young people and black folks? I heard Paul Rosen say one time, never forget the soil from which you sprung.
Right.
You understand me?
Right.
Never forget the soil from which you sprung. He has never forgotten.
Right.
None of us have forgotten. Look how we got here. We're standing on the shoulders of people that died and suffered for us, and we let people make a trick out of us and take our money. The police over here abuse these children, these boys. I treat the homeless at 3 o'clock at night. I come home, I see the temple police have these boys outside, up there on Broad Street, up against the wall.
Tell the story.
Violating their rights. Though the white man says, yo, right, well, the rights must don't apply to them. Norris home sitting back there, they got all them damn lights on. How can them women and children go to sleep? If a boy run over here, the police, the temple police, are run over there like they frantic sissies. I'm sick of it. This is fine, but the ones we want is in this building. And we need to go in that door. We need to let them know that we know where they are, and then we demand justice for Dr. Montero. We demand justice for those children in public housing. We demand justice for these black men in the city of Philadelphia. We don't get none of this goddamn work when they build all these ivory towers. We demand justice for black people who are being regentrified in the city. You cannot stand here. You have to take the fight to them.
Amen.
They don't give a damn. But when they see black folks coming up in that building, that make a difference. Now, you temple police, come on, because I'm going in the goddamn building.
That was Zachary Rhodes. The activist staged a sit-in outside the Board of Trustees meeting and later met with the president of Temple University, who confirmed that Professor Molefi Asante had indeed participated in the firing of Dr. Montero. Finally, it was Dr. Montero's time to speak. He blasted Temple's role in the gentrification of the surrounding black community and said black and progressive academics have also been to blame.
We let corporate types run the university, set the goals, establish the curriculum, fire and hire as they decided, tenure who they wanted to tenure, and kick out of the university those who are unacceptable to them. Those who said that it is difficult to explain the action against me unless we also take into account what I stand for. Yes, I stand with Mumia Abdul-Jamal and have for over 30 years since he was arrested. But if that is so bad, well, I stood with Nelson Mandela when he was in prison and on the United States terrorist list. I stood with Russell Maroon Schultz and other political prisoners and prisoners of conscience, like Chelsea Manning, like Edward Snowden, like Julian Assange. So if it's a question of, Dr. Montero, you are too political. Well, if I'm too political in standing with Mumia and political prisoners and prisoners of conscience, then are you telling me I should not have stood with Nelson Mandela? Some will say you are Marxist and a socialist. That you teach W.E.B. Du Bois's magnum opus, Black Reconstruction in America. That you teach C.L.R. James and Amiri Baraka.
All right.
Are you telling me that you can have a Department of African American Studies without teaching the radical tradition and the traditions of socialism? And if that's what you're telling me, then you're telling me that you want a department built upon a lie. I live in North Philadelphia, have always lived in North Philadelphia, and will continue to live in North Philadelphia. I don't own a car, I ride the buses. And I ride the buses for the same reason that I live in the neighborhood that I always lived in. I like to be among ordinary people. I like to feel what they feel. I like to see how they're looking from day to day. How is this society affecting them? I enjoy living in North Philadelphia. I like to live next to black people. Always have. But I am not going to back up and say that my life world should be transformed because rich people now want to inhabit the cities. I'm going to fight that.
All right.
I'm going to fight it. And in fighting against gentrification, we are fighting against poverty. We're fighting against the prison industrial complex. You know, there are a lot of people who want to study the prison industrial complex but not study poverty. They want to study the prison industrial complex but not study gentrification. They want to study the prison industrial complex but not study the effect of neoliberal corporatized universities upon communities. These institutions are as negative in the life of communities as the prison industrial complex is. In other words, they break up communities in the same way that mass incarceration does. Where do we go from here? I thought about this, and I would propose, as we do what we have to do, we're going to have to think about a new dean of the College of Liberal Arts. We have to. This is not retaliatory or revenge. It is a practical proposal based upon a job failure. The job was not done well. You did not understand the environment. that you were in. You didn't understand the people who are your neighbors. You did not even understand your faculty. But what is the philosophical grounding of that person who would be our next dean of the College of Liberal Arts? I would suggest that that person proceed from a philosophical grounding that I call the Russell Conwell, Marvin Walkman, W.E.B. Du Bois paradigm for higher education. Russell Conwell's commitment to the poor and working class, albeit they immigrants and white. Marvin Walkman's socialism arising out of the European Holocaust against the Jews, coming to the United States and teaching and heading a historic black college, Lincoln University, and then coming here to Temple to infuse that ideology and extend, as it were, Russell Conwell's vision. But then higher education cannot be higher education without W.E.B. Du Bois, without his understanding of the function and purpose of higher education. And so I would propose that a project for all of us is that we think of the type of dean of the College of Liberal Arts that we need, and that Philadelphia needs, and that North Philadelphia needs. And that person should be acquainted when they come here with the philosophy of Russell Conwell, Marvin Walkman, and W.E.B. Du Bois. I don't care how long your resume is, but if you don't understand basic principles, you can't do the job. Finally, to my colleagues on the faculty here, join us. Join the almost 200 scholars who have signed a call for the reinstatement of Dr. Montero from around the country. Don't be afraid. There's cover. Cornel West, Angela Davis, Robin Kelly, Joe Fagan, 200 of them. Join them. In joining them, we as a faculty join the cafeteria workers, who are our colleagues. They're not our servants. We join the security guards. We join the maintenance workers. An injury to one is an injury to all. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. If the workers in the cafeteria making a less than livable wage, we on the faculty should be concerned. If their lives are difficult in NARS homes, we on the faculty should be concerned. There is no hiding place. That's what neoliberal capitalism teaches us in the first decade and a half of the 21st century. That if they come for the people in NARS homes today, they're coming for you tomorrow. Your PhD cannot shield you from the ravages of neoliberal capitalism. And lastly, let me say this in my own defense. It has been said by some, even written in newspapers, that Dr. Montero is not that important. That we can replace him with scores of professors. They're out there. He hasn't done that much. In fact, he hasn't written a book. They say that they're moving in a new direction, ill-defined though it be. And in this new direction, we don't need the black radical tradition. I think to those people, we would ask that they come forward with their proposal, not just for African American studies, but for the university as a whole. And if you think that African American studies can go forward without the African American community, you must believe that you can have black art and black music without black people. African-American studies emerged out of the struggles of ordinary black people who did not ask for anything and did not get anything. If we are professors, it is because of millions of unnamed black people, many of whom became martyrs in the struggle for our freedom.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Melissa Gerson.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.